Come on, Annie. Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
Cowboy yeah, like, so what do you like best about me? Robbers,
glamour and strife,
that'll be the question.
Bigger than life.
But actually.
Oh, your personality.
So welcome to a podcast of one's own. After a brief hiatus, we're back after the Christmas season to talk about basically movies we've seen since last time we all sat together in a room. We have kind of an assortment, and we're going to interrogate them, I guess, from a few different angles.
And I guess, like, spoilers for all movies that have happened in the past month.
And we don't even
fully know what will come up, so spoilers.
And spoilers probably for, I don't know.
The Wire.
Definitely for Boardwalk Empire, because that's my favorite spoiler. I don't know, I think, oh, maybe American Horror Story, if I can think of any. I'm not watching it, I just assume I can think of some spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but before we launch into that, we were trying to come up with sort of an elegant segue, and we can't. But since we're talking about movies, and since sometimes on dates you go to movies,
yep.
Do you think it's possible to date, perhaps go to a movie with, someone who isn't a feminist?
I mean, the biggest trouble with going to a movie is afterwards, and then having to talk to them about it, and you're like, that was really problematic for gender reasons. And then
have them be like, oh, I liked the shot of the sky.
Yeah.
Or just interrogated from it. Well, I guess the whole thing is the idea of even, but whenever you go see a movie with someone, when you are approaching it on different planes afterwards, it does mean that you're not having the discussion you'd like to be having, but it also does symbolize that you're watching things in a different way because your values are different.
Sky and I were talking about this very question not too long ago. And I said, like, there is a difference between, like, not a feminist and, like, actively not a feminist. Like, I could definitely date someone, I say definitely, but, you know, maybe not definitely. I could date someone who didn't identify as a feminist or even feminist positive or whatever. But if they actively hated feminism or, like, were misogynist, and obviously I couldn't date them.
Well, I don't even know, though, that I could do that. Like, I don't think any of us could be, like, date, like, a feminist hater.
I'm just not sure in what world we would, like encounter one.
Yeah. But, well, I actually met a lot of
There's
people that way.
There's someone in my program that super is. But, like, and they're, like, a well-educated, like, human.
Sure, but, like, encounter in the sense that, like, it would be in any world that you would come close to dating them. Like, that's just such a
well,
massive
Well, certainly when
of...
I lived in the Maritimes, I would know a lot of people, like, who are not, like, actively against it, but we're, like, very sexist.
Oh,
and thought feminism was dumb.
And obviously in Alberta, like, people
and
think
here
it's ridiculous,
too,
but...
like, let's not say that Toronto is, like, the most feminist place in the world, but, like...
But I sort of more mean, like, the question I think is less about, like, would you date a misogynist? Like, that's not quite...
That's what I'm saying, like, there is something that isn't not a feminist, but not a feminist.
But what I was going to say about that was, like, for me, which I've thought about this a lot, because I know a lot of really, like, great people. I have a lot of really good friends that are wonderful people that are really smart and that aren't really, like, feminist, or not even just feminist, but they don't really think about gender very much, and sort of gender and, like, identities and stuff like that. And I actually think, and I've dated people like that, but I actually think at this point in my life, I'm not sure that I could, because... it's such a big part of my identity to talk and think about this stuff. It's like, what would I talk to this person about if I can't talk to them about gender?
If it's, like, everything else.
But, like, I mean, there'd be a big hole. Like, I'd want to come and, like, I would want to, like, meet up with them, and I would inevitably want to talk about this stuff
because
I see it in everything.
Just because they're not a feminist, why does that, like, mean that you can't talk about feminism?
Well, I don't want to just talk about it and have them, and not, like, I mean, I don't mean that they don't have to be a feminist, but they have to be able to, like, engage in a conversation with about gender, and if they can't do that, I just would feel like, if that would fall flat, I don't know, I don't think that we would have a lot in common.
But you can have a conversation about gender, even an intellectual one that isn't offensive, without being a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Or even, I mean, all of us have our own versions of feminism as well.
And that's what I'm saying, I guess. I guess I'm saying this person doesn't need to be, like, a feminist, but they need to be, like...
Gender conscious,
or thinking about gender, or able to, like, have, like, a discourse around gender and gender politics. Like, I don't give a shit if they call themselves a feminist or not.
Yeah.
But you have to mentally be able to kind of ascribe them feminist qualities.
Yeah, sure. You have to be able to call them feminist. That's funny.
So it's not about self-identification. It's about them having the qualities
that I find feminist.
Yeah. Personally, like, gender politics are in the top five of things I analyze when I first see a film, but it's not the first dialogue I go to. Yeah. And so for me, I wouldn't need that to be the first conversation I have with someone with whom I am romantically seeing a movie.
But you don't even call yourself a feminist, so it's definitely coming from a different place of, like, whether you would date a feminist
or not. I wouldn't date someone who dismisses out
not
of
a feminist. Yeah.
Or no, but someone who also dismisses that dialogue out of hand.
Yeah,
so
for
if
sure.
I, like, have an interpretation or have my opinions about a gendered reading of a thing and they don't listen or contribute, like I think you were saying, I would find that unattractive, but that's mostly just because it seems less thoughtful.
Yeah, if they did that about anything,
not just gender,
they would be a bad person.
That's thoughtful.
Like, that doesn't mean anything specific.
But I don't mean
gender.
Thoughtful. I don't mean thoughtful about me. I mean thoughtful about things generally.
Yeah, totally. It would just make them shitty.
But it's just more about the idea of, like, if that's not a thing they're willing to interrogate in art, then
I
think that it's.
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything that's important to you. And
it's
they
not
have
about
to
it being
important
to me. I mean, specifically gender, if it's not something they're willing to interrogate in art, I would find that to be unattractive.
I agree. I would as well. I mean, and I think there's, like, it's not necessarily anything, but there's certain things, and gender is one of the things that I would need somebody to be willing to talk about. And, like, you'd also want someone who would be willing to talk about, like, you know, like, race politics in a film, or, like, identity, like, sexual identity politics, and it would be weird if they dismissed any of those things. I go to gender really quickly because, like, it's just very salient because we talk about it all the time, so it's easy to kind of pull out that lens for me. But, like, I'd want somebody, I'd want someone who can flexibly shift between different discourses willingly, basically.
I exactly agree with that, yeah.
But I also wanted to kind of bring up, I was just sort of thinking, another component, like, aside from, like, going on a date, but, like, being in a relationship with somebody, I actually think it would be different for me depending on whether I was dating, like, a woman or a man, because when you're in a heterosexual relationship as a feminist, there's a lot of weird gender politics that you notice and attend to, and just for me and my relationships, those are politics and dynamics that, like, I want to talk about and deconstruct from a feminist lens. So I'd actually really need to date somebody who would be, like, willing to enter into that conversation with me as well. As, like, even though, like, we're talking about dynamics coming from different perspectives, like, if they are coming from, like, a male perspective, basically.
I think that there's, or at least I think I have the attitude, that you have to try a lot less hard to be a feminist in a woman same-sex relationship. There's just something that seems automatically less difficult about being a feminist there, whereas you have it, like, to me it seems like you have to take a stance of some sort in a heterosexual relationship, and that's probably, like, closed-minded of me, but I feel like there'd be a lot more conscious navigating, or a different kind of conscious navigating.
Yeah, I
in
think
a heterosexual
just
relationship.
I don't know how to put it. I guess just for me, some of the weirder or more uncomfortable anxieties around things like identity and sex and gender politics become really loud in heterosexual relationships. Mm-hmm. And, like, you, I recognize them, and I, like, I have to talk about, to have a sex, like, a successful relationship, I need to talk about those kinds of things. So I need to date somebody who could talk about them with me.
Mm-hmm. What about someone who disagreed, but intellectually?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's allowed to, we disagree on things all the time, but if you're open to the conversation, then it doesn't matter. Like, I'm not an anarchist, but I would love to take part in an anarchist conversation.
You just love neck tattoos.
But so I also love anarchy, so it's not the best, it is not the best example, but I couldn't think of something, but, like,
meat
long as you're
pizza.
Willing to talk in a different way and learn something, like, you can't just.
Bacon, efficient, farmer, meat farmer. 6 different kinds of meat. Loves them.
No, I mean, I couldn't
local
date that.
Local organic. What if it's, like, a local grassroots farm that's
totally.
Organic, raises its own meat, you know, like,
no Portlandia
antibiotics.
Hippie
that
farmer.
Is hot.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. I don't care. I don't know how we got from anarchist to that.
She
but
was just trying.
Because you said you like anarchy, so I was trying to find something that
right,
was
but a political mode of thinking.
But I think that, sorry, I cut you off, but I think that there is a difference there, that, like, we disagree, but we can disagree and be fine with it because we all have, like, a couple very core values that are central, one of which is, like, we talk about gender and, like, deconstructed, and I think we would all agree that, like, some kind of equality would be a good thing, and that right now there isn't one. Like, that's, like, a pretty central tenet of a lot of feminist discourse, and for me, I know, I actually do know, and I'm good friends with somebody who is really smart, really, really, like, right-wing, and actually disagrees with those basic tenets, and it's, I love this person, but it's so hard to talk to them about these issues, because yeah. It, even though they're talking about it intellectually, it feels personal.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, what's better, disagreeing with someone, and, like, being able to be in a smart, conversation, or, like, dating someone that is just going to agree with you. I mean, I think that would be way more boring, because you're just unloading your feminist discourse onto these guys who say that they're feminists, but, like, don't actively do anything feminist.
The people who absorb and just want to agree.
Yeah, and they're like, yeah, you're so right, you should be angry. I'm angry now, too. And you're like, cool, but, like,
no, dissent,
you know,
is a
why
video,
don't we
yeah,
talk
don't
about
any
it
of us
ways.
Would be attracted to people who we can't learn anything from, though. Like, you know, like, who you can't kind of, like, have conversations with that will respond.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know. I think that what I seek from relationships isn't necessarily always a debate. And I like to be able to have things about some things, but it's not always what I want.
Yeah.
Like, I'm much less about that conversation and much more about other things. And obviously, like, fundamental disagreements, like, that are things I believe strongly in, like, things I consider to be, like, core values to myself, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to. But things that are more incidental to me, I can just not talk about them. And as long as it's not something that I consider the other person lesser for believing, I can be okay with dating
but
them.
I think it comes to, I agree with you completely, but I think it comes back to, like, this idea of flexibility. Like, I wouldn't want a partner who I debate with all the time that is so smart and, like, I respect, but we constantly debate. I wouldn't want a partner who just agrees with me either. And you want somebody who, you know, there's going to be times where you disagree and you can respectfully and intellectually do that. You want someone who can, like, you know, you can have, like, heated conversations where you're both sort of on the same page and you're just kind of escalating each other with ideas, and then some where, like, probably there will be conversations where the person's not interested and it just falls flat, or they just absorb. And, like, you want somebody who can encapsulate all of those things.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to just debate for a whole relationship.
I think we're, like, missing such a big point. Again, me being the only single person here, it's going to be hilarious that I'm saying this. But, like, there's so much more to relationships than just, like, what your politics are and mm-hmm. what you agree on and, like, the kind of things that you like.
No,
and, like, you
yeah.
can say it in really hippy-dippy terms, which is what I probably would, but, like, to go over that and try not to, there is something else there, that mm-hmm. there is, like, a communication happening between people
yeah.
that isn't on any of these levels. That's far more important than
no,
any of the things that we're talking
and
about.
And that's the thing, is I think that when I consider what I hypothetically would want from a relationship and what actually I am good at doing in relationships are very different. And a lot of things are going to be overlooking.
Yeah.
And not talking about things and not fostering disagreements, because sometimes that debate is valuable and sometimes I think it isn't. So, like, I couldn't date someone who is, you know, like we said, like, I couldn't date a misogynist, obviously. I could date someone who I think needs some learning done.
Yeah, who's open in any sort of way,
yeah.
but you want to be open, you or yourself want to be open, and
yeah.
you want other people to be open.
To someone.
Like, that's, like, a different quality.
Though, I will say that, like, when I meet guys who aren't, like, I agree with you completely, but when I meet people who aren't, like, necessarily misogynistic, but who are, like, just kind of sexist dudes that, like, you know, like, it's pretty common, like, demographic.
Not attractive.
Yeah, but it's, like,
I'm very unattracted, like, immediately, and I think it's not necessarily, like, it's not that it's just on a political, intellectual level. I agree that
totally.
That dynamic's more important, but for me, there are moments where my politics and my, like, personal life are so fused that, like, to see somebody who saying something sexist or, like racist or, like, weird, like, slightly, like, homophobic or something like that is, like, it's personally very, like, unattractive, and then at that point, like, I cannot connect with that person.
Yeah, of course, but that's very different from having, like, abstract, they're being offensive. They're offending
yeah.
you, and they're offending people around you. That's, like, of course that's not attractive, that you take that emotionally, regardless of, like, if they think women, whatever feminist thing, I can't even
yeah.
think of
should
one.
Churn butter.
Yeah.
Churn butter.
Yeah, I can't think of a single
and tend to the cattle
thing. Yeah, but so, you know, that's, again, on a different level, rather than, you know, do they believe in the Communist Party?
or
no, the Communist Party would be stupid.
Conservative Party.
Both stupid.
Movies.
Movies. Well, okay. I mean,
now that we've
solved that one.
Yeah, we could date anyone, or we could take anyone to a movie as long as they're an open person.
And I think that
not offensive.
A thing that we didn't bring up is also like great looking. And yeah. I just want to touch on that because
sure. I think we've all been attracted to sexist, great-looking people.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And the thing is, part of it is really attractive people make me so nervous. I probably wouldn't be outspoken because I'd be like, "This person is this good-looking, and maybe they'll touch me later," and I would probably panic. And they're like, "You know what women should do? Churn butter." And I'd be like, "Ee." And I don't know.
Just take out your butter and your churner
and my churner.
And just start churning
my pocket churner that I got for Christmas. And then I would just, whip some stuff up and we'd have some bread and butter by candlelight, which I would have made in my wax.
I would be like, "I'm vegan," and then leave.
run away. You wouldn't. They're so handsome. Intimidatingly handsome. So movies. I mean, okay, freshest on my mind, I saw The Hobbit IMAX 3D in 24 frames, not in the high frame rate.
Me too.
Yesterday. What did you guys see recently?
I saw Django last night.
Yeah. I saw Django a few days ago, and The Hobbit. Are we just listing off movies?
And that's going to be the whole podcast. All right. And then we're going to go back to movies from childhood. Okay. Like The Secret of Nim, The Land Before Time 1.
I saw Life of Pi and So Did the Sky, but we're not going to talk about it.
The whole thing about that is, like, I think the book is overrated and kind of stupid.
Well, that's because we were all given it to read in grade 11.
I don't know. I don't think it's kind of stupid, and it's obviously overrated, but I enjoyed the movie.
Yeah.
I'll say that much.
But, like, in the way that you enjoyed Avatar, which I also enjoyed Avatar, because it was spectacular.
I enjoyed it on a different level than I liked Avatar.
Oh, okay.
Definitely, because there are, near the beginning of Life of Pi, which is the one thing that we said we weren't going to talk about, it kind of has nicer emotional resonance. Like, there is, something, as much as they want it to, like, make you believe in God, the movie doesn't do that as well as the book does it, works at all, but the book is definitely more spiritual, but near the beginning, you can kind of see the spiritualness with him, like, liking different religions and taking them apart and being a little bit more meditative, and then the rest, it kind of, near the ending, it just becomes too black and white. Like, here's what really happened. Instead of in the book, I feel like it was a little less like, this might have happened, but it might have been this way. But
so it was very clear.
And so it goes with God. But this one, it was very clear, like, oh, here's the real story. This kid made it up because he can't deal with it.
Because he's emotionally traumatized.
Yeah, and that makes it less like, and so it goes with God. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it makes it less provocative in that way. Let's move on from Life of Pi.
Playbook.
We saw that. Then Argo.
I want a quick pause back to Life of Pi and just that, like, it's a stupid name for a thing.
Life of Pi?
I think it's dumb. I think it's a dumb name.
I mean, it's not the best name.
It's a bad one.
But I guess it's been with us for so long.
It sounds like I don't know. There's something about it. Maybe it's making fun of coming-of-age stories. Maybe it's deliberately winking. There's just something about it that I
find
really...
anything with the name Life in it is probably not the best thing.
Life and Times...
You don't have to think about it. I'm just saying. I think it's just pretty dumb.
I love that when
you say something like that, like, my immediate urge is, like, think of life things that are good.
Kara, we're dissenting against you.
But I did think of My So-Called Life. I don't know if any of you guys have seen
it. I love My So-Called Life.
Yeah, well, then, there you go.
You proved me wrong. You're never going to watch it.
Yeah, I didn't. I watched the first few episodes, and I was like, oh, your face.
She's so good in it. It's great. Okay, so The Hobbit, for me, I have nothing.
Wait, Homeland finale?
God damn it. I don't care if you guys spoil it. I think I'm over Homeland.
Okay, but we're not going to do that. No, it's really bad, but we should do a separate episode on it.
Okay, into that. And I can be spoiled from it, and I'll have opinions.
This is the podcast future planning.
We're just going to say, actually, that's really funny. This is how we decide what podcast we should do.
This is the maintenance episode.
So not Life of Pi. We're not doing a podcast on that.
Nice, okay.
But we are going to do one on Homeland.
This is going to be like Tristram Shandy, where we never get around to talking about
And we're going to do one on the Doctor Who Christmas special.
But Kate has to watch it first.
Just so you know, audience,
it's Kate December 29th, and Kate hasn't watched it.
She's watching it with her friend, Heather.
I literally watched it 15 minutes after it aired on the PVR.
I watched it the next day because I had plans to watch it and eat chicken burgers, which was great. They're vegans. They hate this.
Kate's not a vegan.
I'm not a vegan. You're not a vegan either. You ate bacon on Christmas morning.
You know, if I had meat once in the past 2 years, I still think I'm vegan. Or I eat vegan.
I thought...
Do we want to go into the politics of meat? Saying that.
No.
Because people are always like, hey, oh, look, and I'm going to do it anyway.
We all said no.
Because people are like, how can
we
you
We did not consent to this.
Vegan?
Are we right. dressed in a way that's provoking
Argo.
This response from you?
Argo? Or what should we start with?
I wanted to
Django?
Just... I wanted to, like, for me, none of these movies that I saw, because I mean, I saw Lincoln, I didn't see Silver Lining, I saw, well, we all saw Cloud Atlas, I guess that's the last one back in the day, but I have not seen any of these movies that have made me have any massive opinions about the gender dynamics in them, but also all the movies I've seen have been, like, very much male protagonists and very much about them. Like, the main plot has been about the male protagonist, excepting Argo, I guess, but Argo still has a lot of that.
Argo is still mostly about the male.
Also, did you like that in Argo, he was very Hispanic, and Ben Affleck played him?
Yeah.
At the end of, like, Tony Mendes, and it's, like, this, like, overweight Hispanic guy.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah,
oh,
no.
Ben.
Okay, so which movie should we start with?
The Hobbit had Kate Blanchett looking beautiful.
For a minute.
For a minute.
Okay, so let's do The Hobbit. Initial reaction, it was boring.
It was too much exposition. Why were there musical sequences? Also, the line, this is not a thunderstorm, this is a thunder battle, is the worst line ever written by anything ever, and I'm going to use it all the time.
I don't think it's the worst line ever written.
It's so bad. Also, what kind of, my friend Alvin said this in the theater, when they're lighting pine cones on fire to throw at the dwarves, and I quote, what kind of wizard doesn't have a basic fire spell?
True.
Yeah, Gandalf seems like, I'm not as big into Lord of the Rings as you guys are, but Gandalf seems like the worst wizard and can't do shit.
Are you sure?
Kidding?
Because there was that brown
you
wizard.
You shall not pass? Are you sure?
That was at the end of his...
He made a thing with his thing.
Okay, well...
Wow, I'm so impressed that he made a thing with his thing and then turned white.
I mean, he totally banished the Balrog using his staff. Yes, sacrificed himself. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, that was nice,
but
was
that
very magical, or was that a good person thing?
It was also 65 years after this.
Yeah.
At this point, he's like Grey Wizard. Saruman looks awesome, has all the power. Brown Wizard was worse than Gandalf, because all he did was exercise that hedgehog.
Yeah, remember when, he saved a life. What has Gandalf done?
Not much. Lit some pine cones on fire.
Yeah.
And, like, totally forgot about Bilbo for that entire dwarf sequence. Bilbo's, like, off being invisible with the ring. I really liked Martin Freeman. I thought he was very good.
He was very good. But, and then Gandalf knows that Martin Freeman has the ring, and he's just like, let's move on.
He just glances at it briefly.
Yeah.
I liked that, though, like, seriously, the entire dwarf chasing sequence, which was dumb, and which is why when 3D movies do stuff like that looks like a Disney ride or look like it's setting me up for when the Disney ride comes out,
yeah.
I hate it. I don't care about fun chase sequences. Also, all the cliffs in the world. So many deep depths.
So, gender. Why? I mean, I know that it was written a while ago, and it's based off a book, but obviously every character, except for Kate Blanchett, who is in it for, like, a second,
yeah. And isn't a character.
No. Yeah, she doesn't do anything, is a man.
Well, I haven't seen... Well, I haven't seen this movie or
oh, really?
Read the book, but if I can take it broader to talk about Lord of the Rings as well, to talk about those gender politics,
yeah.
I mean, I think... Like, Lord of the Rings, even though I totally loved it growing up, I'll have you all know, Kate already knows this, but when I was in grade 6, I had a Hobbit hole cake for my birthday party with little figurines on it.
That's really cute.
Loved it, yeah. So, anyway, but it is the worst for gender, because the only two female presences in that narrative are Kate Blanchett and Arwen.
Okay, fuck yourself, Eowyn, who
slays
the Witch King
true.
Of the North.
She actually...
And is no man.
Yeah, she is actually... Never mind.
I don't know who she is.
She's really female positive.
She slays the Witch King of the North, and she is no man.
Yeah, but who is she?
She's,
she's, like, actually, like, a pretty feminist
She's
character.
The niece of Théoden King.
No, who's she played by?
Oh, Miranda...
Richardson.
Maybe.
No.
She's Australian.
She a dwarf? Who is she?
She's a
she
human.
She lives in Rohan. She becomes big in the third movie.
She had a crush on Aragorn, but Aragorn's all
like
getting
no
it on
dice.
With that elf lady.
Yeah, because he's all into Arwen. And then,
I'm
so
no
basically, she kills,
this,
like, a really
fundamental
character, and then the evil villain, when he's dying, says, I can't be killed by any man, and she takes off her helmet and says, I'm no man. She's also very good at swordplay.
She's like
a little Arya.
She's
like,
she's like a big Arya, really,
yeah,
I would say.
Arya.
Big blonde Arya.
But in The Hobbit...
In the
There's
Hobbit,
no female positive characters.
Not at all.
And it's boring.
Well, you know, actually, so I have a question about that. A lot of those kinds of narratives don't introduce female characters sort of under the guise that they're about, like, sort of male camaraderie and brotherhood and whatever. And yeah. I was just wondering, like, does introducing women really compromise that narrative or that message, that theme of brotherhood? And, like, what the fuck? Why?
But why can't... Well, I think
why not
touched
just
on,
camaraderie and community? And,
I think we've touched on this thematically before, like, the idea of, like, can girls be bros? But the idea of... There's, like, this insularness to, like, male camaraderie that...
Totally.
Like, there seems to be an impulse in, especially, like, Hollywood narratives and such things... That has to be closed to women because they just won't understand and the brotherhood will be broken. A thing I want to bring up, and I think we'll touch on it in future podcasts, but, like, I'm playing through the Mass Effect series right now, and it's also present in other BioWare games. But I find that that dynamic is really well explored because you have your pick of different characters to add to your party, and you can mix and match the genders, and it doesn't change the tightness of the community. And I think that dynamic doesn't, like, the party dynamic... featuring female has now become a lot, like, it's a lot tropier in films. Like, you'll have, like, the brotherhood of men and then, like, the token girl. Who's
yeah,
like...
I was gonna, like, my addition to this is I think lots of the reasons why it doesn't happen is because war is usually associated with brotherhood, and so they always have to be together.
And, like Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit are also very much steeped in that.
Yeah,
like, in, like,
exactly.
World War II. And...
And so... there's that part where, like, women shouldn't or can't or wouldn't be allowed to be mm-hmm. in the army. But there's also, like, if there is women present in the Brotherhood, they kind of have to have an excuse of why that woman isn't a romance interest.
Yeah.
Like, they have to make it up. So it feels like it'd be even adding extra to be, like, okay, we have to give this specific one a backstory of, like, is she too unattractive? Is she already taken? Yeah. Is she a lesbian? Like, they have to develop her specifically because we as an audience just can't accept.
She's gonna Yoko up the fellowship.
Yeah, we can't just accept. Yoko Ono is a genius.
Yoko Ono's
she
so
had nothing
amazing.
To do with the Beatles breaking up.
Kidding. No, it was mostly the manager.
So, you know, I think that's part of just an ease. An
probably
ease.
Just Paul was a dick.
Well... Let's Paul apparently was, I was just reading about this today, but as we all know, Yoko did not break up the band,
no,
but Paul, everyone was scared of it becoming, like, Paul's band. Like,
yeah,
it was
Paul
going
was
too much more towards
kind
it.
Kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the spoilers for the Beatles.
You hear that,
they break
Paul?
Up.
You're a dick.
You're
but, you know,
McCartney.
He's an amazing artist, so I don't want to insult him too much.
I agree with
he's
you
so
about
amazing.
This idea of, like, you can... Maybe it's just a matter of, like, it's narrative shorthand. You don't have to do as much explaining, because the, like, man-on-man camaraderie is already such a trope, like, already so steeped in our understanding of works of art that we don't have to go an extra mile to establish a dynamic. So they throw 14 dwarves at us, and a burglar, and a wizard, and we can accept that, but once that's interrupted, it becomes, like, this movie's already 3 hours long, we're going to spend 15 minutes... trying to make you okay with a non-normative
and a non-important character. Like, how, like, what are the important ones? Like, Finny and Yinny?
Definitely is Finny and Yinny. Well, like, Thorin.
Yeah, Thorin, and then the two ones with the rhyming names.
Can I also just say that I called at the very beginning of the movie, I'm like, I bet the dwarves, who are handsome, are the narratively important ones. The ones who barely have beards
they
and
are,
don't have
I mean, have you guys read the book?
Back in the day, I don't remember.
I was gonna say because one of the two. Can I spoil it?
No, yes. Spoilers for the Hobbit book.
Dies, either Finny or his other one
like
that runs.
Like Fred George,
Remy.
Yeah, exactly. Classic. Like Fred and George. And so you know, there's the one hot one who I don't know.
Oh my god,
his
he
name
was so
was.
Hot though.
He was so hot. It was like you could have thrown in a few more hot.
He
dwarfs.
Just looks like a dude, though. He doesn't look like a
dwarf. Yeah, no, he doesn't look like a dwarf.
He doesn't even look short.
But he's hot. Okay, but the other than like. I mean, obviously there are problematic gender things, but I think that's so common in this genre.
In fantasy, or in high fantasy, specifically.
Yeah, exactly. Not, like, Twilight, but, like...
quick pause.
No, I was, like, making a point, but, alright.
Go ahead.
Nope, I want to hear what you say now.
Quick pause. At lunch today, there was a guy wearing, like, a Team Edward shirt, but the Edward shirt was Edward Adama from Battlestar Galactica, and it was excellent.
That's funny.
Go on.
The biggest problem with the movie is, like, its one-noteness. Like, just the structure of it is so flat.
That's because The Hobbit isn't even supposed to be a full movie, never mind three.
Yeah, it's pretty short. Children's book.
I mean, it should be one movie. It would have, like, a nice arc to it. Because, you know, they have shit to it. But it doesn't have to be three.
For me, the reason that, well, one of the main failings for me, and I'm placing it against Lord of the Rings, and trying to figure out, like, how deeply invested I was in Lord of the Rings when I first watched it, because it was, like, a fandom I entered very fully and cared about a lot, and I watched the movie all the time, and I drew a lot of, like, comfort and pleasure from watching and rewatching those.
Because I drew a lot of slash
because I wrote a lot of... I didn't draw slash fan art. I did draw fan art. And I wrote non-slash fan fiction, but no slash. So
I never wrote slash anything.
For life. But for me, the main difference, and this is... like, really key for me, is I didn't care about the relationships in this, because the dwarves all looked the same, because I'm dwarf racist.
And Thorin was really boring.
And Thorin was shit. Yeah. Thorin was, like, an awful dwarf.
Yeah.
And a bad king, and boring, and all he did was carry around that log, and he wasn't that good at combat.
Yeah.
And I didn't care about the pale orc friend.
Because he's not important to the ultimate story. He's just, incidental. Like, a kind of a side thing, and so they're setting it up, and it's just like, ugh.
But
whatever.
the party dynamics are also established that these 14 people are friends, and they're uniform, and Bilbo feels like an outsider, and there's no negotiation between them to, like, become friends and get to know each other in the way that a typical party dynamic is all the characters getting to know each other, so we're getting to know them.
Right.
And they're all growing to like each other, and we're all growing to like them and like them together, and it's this journey, and it's this relationship that we're developing as they develop a relationship, and there's zero of that there. There's 14 dwarves, who I don't care about,
who already know each other, and you learn backstory through these, like, long, epic things.
Yeah, and, like, awkward ones, or, like, maybe some musical sequences where there's some dishes thrown about.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, a giant headbutts another giant, and I don't care, because I just want to see, like, Legolas and Gimli trying to figure out how to get along.
Is Legolas in The Hobbit?
No, but his dad is played by Lee Pace, that's that long-haired blondie with the dark Thranduil.
I don't give a shit if it's not Legolas.
He's so hot
with his wig on.
Lee Pace is pretty hot, too.
Aragorn was obviously the best-looking person
I miss Aragorn.
This is the Lord of the Rings foreshadowed the first kind of team alignment of gentlemen and hot men.
I don't think
team
anybody...
team Aragorn.
Except for, no, you don't, they
some
don't
serious
need...
brawls between nerdy children.
No, but
okay,
I also...
because they just fucked each other. Guys.
Yeah, but also, when I first watched it, remember that it came out when we were in grade 7. When I first watched it, I was in love with Elijah Wood. Totally.
I've had...
I thought Legolas looked like a woman.
I loved it.
I've had... yeah, of course we did.
Foreshadowing.
I've had the conversation before, though, where, like, there was something about the kind of guys that I found attractive, and I think, like, this remains a thing that, like, sort of prepubescent before I was, like, sexually active and before I fully understood sex and when sex was still scary, I was much more attracted to the Legolas non-frightening, like, type, and now I'm a lot more into the Aragorn type, and I don't know what the transition
is. I feel like, you know,
well, as you get older, he also looks younger.
Smell. I just think Aragorn.
I missed everything you said until coffee bag smell.
Coffee bags.
Oh. Aragorn,
I just feel like he'd always be really smelly and gross and just disgusting, and Legolas would always be clean and be able to walk on snow
and also sleep with his eyes open. Fucking weird.
I think there's also something important.
Love it.
There is something important about. You know, what you said about kind of having, like, a quote, feminized beauty that you're attracted to when you're younger, but there's also just, like, they look younger and more like you are young.
But...
you know what I mean? Like,
Orlando Bloom in that movie is still older than I am now.
I know, but he looks young. He looks younger than Aragorn looks.
I know what you're saying, but I don't think
I'm not saying it's just that. I think there is something to it, but you have to keep in mind, like, the older we get... the more chance we're going to be attracted to older people, too.
For sure. I think, though, for me, like, it's like, that in a sense that's partly that, but I think that it's more of a movement away from someone who, like, isn't scary.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
Legolas is, like, the opposite of frightening. He, like, is graceful and has, like, flowing hair and...
yeah, but there's also old people are scary. Old people are your discipliners when you're young. And, then, you know, the older you get, the more you're like, George Clooney.
Am I, though?
Well, most people.
Or is it just between Legolas and Aragorn that really this transition has happened?
Aragorn.
I think that, I don't know, so for me, like, The Hobbit failed on multiple fronts, but the main is, like, the times I was actually emotionally invested in The Hobbit, aside from whenever Martin Freeman was being adorable, were the score still hit me really hard. I loved the score. I loved the end credit music, and I don't know why, exactly. But that's the only times it really recaptured how much I cared about it. And I think that was mostly just, like, sense memory. That was just, like, hearing the songs and remembering hearing them when I was excited about the movies, like, 10 years ago, yeah. 12 years ago.
The Lord of the Rings soundtrack is amazing.
It is good.
The score, yeah.
And I think that it was, like, constructed in a way that is very, I think, yeah, like, just bleeds emotion from you. And now would probably, like, make us, like, just so nostalgic to not just have, like, the same music, but, like, the same composer and music that just really is reminiscent of those themes and that kind of feeling.
Have you guys listened to the Radiolab podcast about The Ring and I, about Wagner and The Ring?
No.
I've done.
It's like the soundtrack for the score for Lord of the Rings is highly based off of it.
I wonder if you just like saw that there was a ring in both of them. Howard Shore was like, "Oh, ring."
But it also it's. I mean, it influences a lot of things. We should move on to the next movie.
I have one thing I want to say quickly.
Is it more reviewy or is it about gender?
It's more reviewy, but we say it anyway. I think that also there's a degree to which, like, Lord of the Rings came in a period where, like, it was, like, this immediate post 9/11 where earnestness was a lot more acceptable, and I think we've moved back away from that, and, like, now we're in a post Game of Thrones world, and earnest high fantasy is a lot more difficult to find palatable, and part of that is this, like, that there aren't female characters, and it's just very much calling back to how fantasy was, and fantasy has been since deconstructed and reinvented in a very mainstream way that everyone has seen, and I expect how popular Game of Thrones is probably influenced a lot how lukewarm people are feeling about The Hobbit.
I think that's a really excellent point. Like, I totally agree, really, and I think it's just interesting, also with the idea of, like, camaraderie, and, like, how much we want to see this sort of camaraderie, like, basically just with men, when we've watched things like Game of Thrones, basically, where
Games of Thrones,
where there's basically, like, no such thing as camaraderie in a lot of ways. There's no such thing as that kind of trust and community and support from a group of people. And then, like, coming out of that post 9/11 era that you're talking about, that idea of support and community and camaraderie being much more important and much more, like, not just palatable, but, like,
like, we can band together and really we can fight the dragon.
Exactly.
Or the
or, like, we can, in Game of Thrones, basically, we can say we're going to do that and, like, stab each other all in the backs and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, good.
All right, transition into
Silver Linings.
Silver Linings, which I didn't see.
Do you want to talk about that, Kara?
You can start.
Well, Silver Linings Playbook, Kara and I went to see it because we like Jennifer Lawrence and we like crazy characters on film.
Are they wacky?
No,
wacky
crazy
and actually mentally
ill.
So, Catch Up, just basically, the lead character has, like, bipolar disorder of some sort.
Bradley?
Some sort of,
Is Bradley the main character?
Yeah. And
no, he's diagnosed with bipolar.
Yeah, he's diagnosed with it. Then Jennifer Lawrence plays a female character who, it's implied that she has some sort of mental illness. It doesn't really specify, like, what exactly she's dealing with.
She has depression. It does specify.
That's just what it is?
Yeah,
depressed. Okay. And then I guess she's grieving. And I thought it was really interesting, actually. I really liked the way that that she played that character. I thought she was, I think that sometimes when women are portraying characters that have a mental illness, it can be a little, like, girl interrupted, and it can be really, really, like, feel really theatrical and perpetuate a lot of problematic stereotypes around, like, hysteria. But I thought she was erratic, but she was really good. And I think that you really align with her and like her and care about her.
As much as I think Girl Interrupted is, like, a horrible choice for an example.
Because she
that,
loves Girl Interrupted.
I think there are way worse movies. But it was really interesting. I really liked the movie.
I want to, I guess, kind of bring up the idea of, like, is it, I mean, the value in, like, or I guess, I don't have a question, I just want to hear you guys talk about the idea of, like, identification with a mentally unstable character, mm-hmm. and, like, what that implies, and if that's positive, and, like, if that's actually, like, an amazing artistic idea, if we have more characters that are mentally ill to identify with, will that, like, normalize and make more acceptable mental illness? Like, what do you think?
It depends on the way that it's doing it. In, like, most movies that are about mentally ill, the lead protagonist is, like, questionably mentally ill. Like, yeah. They're always like, am I crazy? Am I not crazy?
Like, they're, like, so pretty high-functioning.
Well,
like,
yeah.
And do we have really examples of this?
Yeah, Girl Interrupted, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it really is that, like, the lead, well, there's not, like, I guess too much, but what it normally feels like to me is that the lead character is, like, is pretty, like, you know, quote-unquote normal, like, whatever that means, and, like, seems, like, maybe a little bit unstable, but not so much, but then they interact with somebody who's, like, really unstable or really erratic, really dramatic, yeah. And then it's really becomes this, like, scopophilic kind of thing where you're, like, watching, like, how crazy people can be, and you could never identify, and it's, I think, in the when well, it's done like that, it's alienating.
There's still someone who's crazier than them.
Yeah,
so.
But it's about, like, you and the main character watching that crazy yeah. person and being, like, wowed, or, you know, by how crazy they are, basically.
And this happens in this movie as well, yeah. Mostly towards What's-His-Face's character. I forget the actor's name.
I don't know what you're talking about. Who?
His only friend.
Oh, the guy who lies a lot.
Yeah.
I forget his name.
Was in that movie with Jackie Chan, Rush Hour.
Owen Wilson?
No. Rush Hour.
Chris Tucker?
Chris Tucker. Yeah, it was Chris Tucker.
I was thinking of High Noon, which is a weirder one to go to.
But I think much less, because Chris Tucker's in it, but he plays a minor role, and sure that he's, like, the butt of a lot of jokes, but, like, it's not so much, I don't think Girl Interrupts like, horrible, and I hate to keep kind of coming to it, but it's just too easy, but, like, it's not so much that, like that, where you're, like, watching Angelina Jolie, and you're supposed to be, like, wow, she's nuts, like, for the whole movie.
I don't think you are supposed to, but we don't have to podcast about
Girl Interrupted. Spoilers for Girl Interrupted.
Yeah.
She's not crazy the whole movie, or is she?
Oh, no.
But, like, anyway, I think that, you know, I guess the reason that I responded very favorably to Silver Linings is that, like, I felt that whatever elements of sort of mental illness were sort of experienced within these characters were not really there to, like, produce some sort of shock or some, like, point of interest for the audience so much as, like, they were, like, another part of that character's experience that at times were a barrier for them and at times were not. So it was, like, a much more holistic portrayal of these characters than having this sort of experience of mental illness be, like, the core piece of their identity and what we see in them.
So there were characters outside of their mental illness, and also the movie wasn't necessarily only about their mental illness.
Yeah, I don't think it was really. I mean, like, obviously, the character and struggling with, like, mania and stuff was a big piece of the plot and what was moving the plot forward and what had created conflicts in his life. But I don't think that, like, you know, like, bipolar disorder, I think, and, like, mania can be done in a lot of ways that are, like, really just producing, like, a shock value and aren't really appreciating sort of the person. And I don't think it was done in that way.
It was done in a way, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but it was done for comic relief, and mm-hmm. it was done to yeah. produce comedy in general.
Yeah.
But it is a comedy lighthearted movie, and, yeah. like, of course it's going to be like that. But I don't think that it was done overly offensively, but I think in doing that, there is less of an identification with the main character, yeah. because you can take a step back, and you're like, oh, look at him have mania. Yeah. It's so funny. It is producing the right effects that the director, whoever it was written for, by once as mm-hmm. like we are laughing with this character, like it's not too mean about it,
mm-hmm.
But it does take away what you were Kate were talking about earlier of like identification with mentally ill. Mm-hmm. It does yeah. not have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually,
it's very outside of the scope. As much as yeah. it can be very relatable, especially Bradley Cooper wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, yeah, I think that's a really good point. And then one thing that I want to make sure that we get to talk about, because, you know, this is supposed to be a gender podcast, this episode, which
whatever,
I guess we've strayed away from a bit.
We're women talking
but,
about a thing.
Yeah.
Just because it's women doesn't mean it's gender.
But Jennifer Lawrence's character is, like, super promiscuous, or portrayed as super promiscuous, and, like, will sleep with a lot of people, and then got fired from her job for, like, sleeping with a bunch of people. And so I just kind of, I guess, wanted to touch on that. And whether or not, like, I hate that or not, I'm not really sure, but, like, why every time we see a woman with a mental illness on film, she's slutty, basically.
Yeah. Like, why is promiscuity a shorthand to
yeah, and why is it that, like, every woman character with a mental illness is, like, oversexed, quote-unquote?
Yeah, I obviously think that that's a huge problem. But I think in this movie it does, like, interestingly undermine it. In that they set up, her husband dies, mm-hmm. and they set up...
How does he die?
Well, let me tell you. she had depression before. It wasn't just triggered by her husband's death.
Oh, that's good.
So she was mentally ill, and then she wasn't having sex with him. Like, she didn't want to have sex as, like, one of the things that can happen with depression. And he went out to go to Victoria's Secret and buy her, like, sexy underwear to, like, maybe help get her in the mood or something. And then on his way back, he got in a car accident and died. And she felt, obviously, immensely guilty. And that's kind of, I guess, the way that she was dealing with her guilt led her to sleep with a bajillion people. And mm-hmm. I think that is, I'm not going to say realistic, but I think it's definitely an interesting way to set up her character, set up her motives of, like, why her mentally ill... ...ness led into promiscuity. I think it makes sense. I think it's great. And it's
not actually touching. Hate it. Like, I actually don't love it because I just feel like, again, it's just another representation of a woman's sexual choices that are portrayed as not her own or not agentic. That, like, she's doing this, again, still because of her, like, dead husband. Or she's doing this still because of guilt, still because of, like... You know, that she can't really be consciously making these decisions on her own. Also, like, I don't want to, like, harp on realism, but I hate those, like, psychoanalytic ties
for me. But I don't think that it is overly psychoanalytic, not that we have to go into it too much, mm-hmm. but I think that if, you know, a big tragedy like that happened, like your husband dying, it would probably change something about your behavior. And if you blame yourself for your own lack of wanting sex... That would probably affect you. But again, not to go into reality. It makes sense in movie terms.
It makes sense narratively. And
yeah.
What I actually want to sort of use that to have you guys mostly discuss the politics of using mental illness and especially like using manic breaks as a way of advancing narrative. Like, because for me that feels a little bit complicated. It feels a little bit like it's not necessarily great writing because it doesn't need to be like motivated. It doesn't need to have like causal ties. But then again, maybe that's like because that's realistic in some ways.
I think that if we're just going to talk about like really good, tight, like mainstream kind of narratives, I think that if it's done in the way that you're mentioning where it's like they basically use an episode of some form of mental illness to, like, totally fuck with the plot without any real context, I think that's just shit writing.
But I feel like even, not quite that, but even, like, that advanced the plot in Homeland.
Yes, yeah.
And I'm sure it advanced the plot in the other two mental illness things we ever talk about, which are Girl Interrupted and One Foot Out of the Cuckoo's Nest, neither of which I remember anything about. But I just mean sort of the idea of, is using mental illness as a method to advance story condescending to mental illness? Is it politically complicated or is it just like another way to tell a story?
I think it can be politically complicated and I think it can be condescending. And I think the times when it is, you're particularly at risk of those things is when you are outside of identifying with the character, sort of like Kara was mentioning. I actually think it was okay in Silver Linings because it's kind of light and they honestly don't alienate the character. I don't think they alienate the characters too much, but I mean, I think that it's fine. I think it's fine to include it because it's part of life. It's part of a lot of people's life and it's part of a reality. And it'd be so silly if there were no movies made about it or no characters in film ever that struggled with some sort of mental illness. But I think that it's, I think if your main character is, if it's going to be a big plot point, or you're going to do something with it significantly, you want to really contextualize everything. And like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm really sick of that kind of black swan-y, very trite kind of shit of like, it's all in their head. That's the plot device. Like the whole way of tying up a plot is being like, oh, they're just crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, like that for me is total shit writing. And that is really problematic and very gendered because it's always women who get that. But
bullshit, Fight yeah, Club.
I guess that's true. I know, true.
There are so many, the men.
Bullshit, Identity. Remember that movie, Identity?
No.
John Cusack.
But I guess
men have that trope a lot. I don't think that specifically...
Yeah, but I think that there is, like, I don't want to get into, like, Black Swan, but there are ways that those things, those sort of psychotic delusional shit is done where it can be, like, really gendered, though you're right that it has been done with men. But anyway, what I was going to say... But it's
done in a different way with men and women.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that, like, I think that if you're going to have mental illness sort of playing an important part of that stage of that film, you need to contextualize their choices and their decisions like you would for any other protagonist. Like, mental illness does not give a writer a pass to not create a real character or, like, a holistic person in their movies, and that's often how it's used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean... Okay, I know that we only have 10 more minutes left, and we should probably talk about a different movie, but I think, like... Never mind, let's just move on.
I'm interested in this one. How much deep things do I really have to say about Argo? Like,
didn't we have another movie?
Django. Django. Fuck it. Wait for Kate to see it. Yeah. You're gonna see it, right?
Yeah.
Or we can... I have zero things to say about it, so...
Yeah, so we'll just skip it.
You know, there's this whole idea of, like, to have you, as you said... Earlier, like, a movie can be shittily written if there isn't cause and effect to every single detail about it.
No, context. I don't mean... It doesn't have to be before, causal.
You did. But even if there isn't context, like, why does it have to be that way? It just, like, if you're gonna be, like, realistic, if you're gonna be about, like, mentally ill, is every single thing in a thing, in your life, is what I mean by in a thing... Does that every single little detail mean something? Can you ever just wake up in a really shitty mood and that be why? Rather than
but
like,
that can be a so, context, so nothing, right? Like,
yeah, but like, why are you in that shitty mood?
Well, not, but I mean,
like what I'm trying to say is, like, when it comes to like depicting mentally ill, we're still putting like mentally ill into these categories, into this system of like cause and effect and context and all of these things that you need to apparently have an intelligible movie. But I think what mentally ill things should open up is a new way of identifying and a new way of understanding.
I guess, yeah, but like, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not saying, I don't mean to conflate causality and context, because I don't think that they're the same thing at all. Like, I think that creating a new backdrop of identifying is to create context. Like, waking up in a shitty mood and then making a bunch of decisions that are influenced by that mood.
No, but why did you wake up in a shitty mood?
But, like you could go back forever. I mean, you can't make a movie that explains every single thing in every single
piece of the narrative. But that's what movies do. That's what every single movie does. Yes, they do. If they're in a bad mood in a movie, it's explained why. If it isn't, it's considered a shitty writing. Like, I think it's less, you can have context for everything, of course, but that context is, like, giving reasons of why this can exist, when really, maybe nothing triggered his mania, and he is just manic.
And I guess that's what I was trying to get at when I said, like, the idea of the implications of writing something where, like, the plot has to advance because of mania, because that is abandoned from causation,
yeah.
And so that within a movie that is otherwise normatively narrative,
yeah,
and therefore based in cause and effect, like, can mm-hmm. that be a successful portrayal? Can that be a portrayal that, like, is structurally empathetic, if that makes sense? Like, a movie, like, would the structure of a film about someone whose life is not cause and effect based because of their chemistry possibly actually portray anything resembling yeah. their actual experience?
Things can trigger mania.
But, sure.
Like, yeah, I know what you mean. I'm not saying that nothing triggers anything, and, like, nothing has,
no,
like,
cause and effect. No, but, so, like, effect, in terms of
saying,
narrative.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But, again, I don't think that, I guess I should qualify what I said, because I don't think that you have to explain everything. Like, I think that it is really valuable to have a film where people just wake up in shitty moods, and don't explain that, because that is, like, just life for most people. So I think that, like, that'd be great, but what I mean is that, like, I guess in terms of, like, characters with mental illness, like, I'm tired of seeing the film where the character is, like, alienated and we don't have to work as audience members or align with them in any way because we are told that they're crazy and that there's no logic to what they do or how they think.
And I guess, like, what I'm saying is, I think, like, along those lines, like, in order for that empathy to happen or that identification, I think that there would have to be, right, assume or have a theory that you the idea of, like, the structures that we normally have with movies and, like, that safety that they create would kind of have to be abandoned because the structures are set up to allow for how people can wake up in shitty moods.
Mm, yeah.
Like, you'd have to dismantle the rest of the structure in order to allow for that part of the narrative
yeah,
to be
and
successful.
The expectations that the structure yields.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure, what do you mean by... Or what are examples of movies that have people just be like, oh, they did this thing and it has no basis in cause and effect just because they're crazy. I mean, I can't think of any... happens
in Girl Interrupted all the time.
Like when?
Like, just, like, all of Angelina Jolie's, like, various freakouts are like, well, there it's just because very... she's crazy. That's it's just because she, like, defies authority and, like, they has no real...
They have so much, like, overly too much of, like, why they do everything. It's like, she's crazy and she's acting bigger than some normal person would, but she's doing it because of all of these reasons. I think that I can't think of anything.
I think the impulse of creating causation, and especially with, like, less so with mental illness, but the impulse to it is pretty well characterized by the, like, the very fact that prequels for every horror film ever exists. This impulse to create and to narrativize motivation, and mm-hmm. instead of having the people who are blind killers, because if you want to talk about someone waking up in a blind, bad mood and we don't know why, like, the killers yeah. in horror films yeah. from the 90s, we don't get to know anything about that. Like, The Exorcist, like, that's someone who woke up in a bad mood, and they don't have motivation. But now we're making prequels, and maybe now more than ever we're trying to create that causal link.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering...
Oh, yeah, everyone must have a really sad backstory as to yeah. why they act the way they do.
Yes.
And that isn't, of course, to say that, like, mentally ill people have no motivations, or nothing has led them to be mentally ill, or anything like that.
Sure.
But it is just a different... They're different motivations than we would normally
mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's really about balancing that, like, line, though. Like, to for any good character, for, like, not people just with mental illness, but, like, any good writing, any good character, but particularly when you're dealing with mental illness, like, balancing the line between making sure that these people, that there is a context, that you're showing some kind of motivation, and that you're, like, also, like, leaving room for the fact that, you know, sometimes people are at the whim of their emotions. Sometimes people don't have control over how they feel, and that's part of it, too. You know, I'm, like, really, like, striking that balance, because really to go one way, too far one way or the other for me is problematic.
Well, for me, if someone, like, in a film acted a certain way, or whenever this happens, because, like, also, I don't know, Kara knows this movie, I'm not sure if you know this movie, I'm terrible at plot, I never understand, like, plots in movies, I'm just bad at understanding why A and B happen, like, causation actually doesn't make sense to me, I'm not good at it, but when it's, so, like, I don't know, maybe it's just, like, I want movies to do it less because I'm bad at noticing it, but when, in a movie, someone is acting in a way that's surprising or doesn't fit with their character, it takes you out of the movie, and it makes you not understand why something is happening. And so when I'm saying that, like, someone acting against the grain of that chain of events happens in a movie, unless it, how disconcerting it is deliberately played with, I think it'd be really hard to portray and not have it, not, like, regardless of sort of no, this is a good point I'm making,
is this the
and now
playlist?
I have a music cue.
No, this is the old Twilight song, because I opened the Twilight.
This is the music cue for my amazing point. Whatever, it's the same point I've been making, but rephrasing it. I
just let it go, let it play out.
Alright.
That's all the points I had to make. I think structure needs to change.
Well, I think it's hard to... No, Twilight. I think it's we're getting too much on, like, a level of should movies have everything be there for a reason or not? And I think we can't answer that question.
But, like as if we can ever answer any of the questions we
get. I know, but I think
it's
like, I mean, I guess you can say yes, things can be there for a reason, or no, things don't have to be there for a reason, for all of these reasons, but it's just like, I don't know.
When something's not there for a reason, it goes into ulti territory, and that's the thing. Yeah. It can't, I think that things can't be that can, it's hard for things to be there for no reason, and for it to feel like the movies that make a lot of money. But then, like, Silver Linings Playbook was a smaller budget film and less widely distributed, so if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in movies like that.
Yeah, but everything happens for a reason in Silver Linings Playbook.
Movies like that, in terms of budget. Right. Not movies like that in terms of content. I haven't seen that. I don't know.
Right.
Thoughts about Django? 2 minutes on Django?
All right, my thoughts. Right. It was entertaining. The race politics are really confusing to me, and so I don't want to say anything about it.
Yeah. They are confusing. That's why I wanted to ask you about it. But we'll talk about it later.
Well,
off the
podcast. No, we can talk about it now. We can do it for a few more minutes.
No!
But, like, I mean, I think it was a really entertaining movie. Violence in movies, I have a lot to say about that because, like, there is this thing, as I may have said on the podcast, or at least said to you guys
we
at some point.
We talked about killing them softly in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like...
Oh, we saw killing them softly.
Don't. The violence in movies is just nuts right now. Like, I hate to be, like,
so wacky.
Such an old person, but it's just, like, they're getting so, so gruesome, and it seems to be, like, we can brush it off as it being okay because it's supposedly a critique of violence because mm-hmm. you're like, oh, look, you're actually seeing how gruesome it would be in real life or, like, something along those that argument. But it's just, like, it's so... How can you critique something by doing it and people still getting enjoyment from it? Like,
for
it's
more.
So... And let me just cite some movies to think about. Killing Them Softly, Django Unchained.
Drive.
What are other recent movies that have done
Well, I was going to say for more on
I
this.
I guess Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah. The movie Funny Games, the Haneke film, oh, both versions are about
that
this.
That is a commentary
it,
on it.
It
That's
actually is.
A true commentary.
Yeah, yeah I mean, it. I think that there is definitely a way... I haven't seen it, so I can't say.
So good.
But if, like...
Like, it's absolutely amazing.
There is a way, obviously, to criticize violence and the violence in movies, but I don't think the way that these, like, mainstream Hollywood movies are doing it is doing it, but I think it is, like, people is citing it as, like, oh, it's okay that they're doing this because it's actually a criticism.
No, it's because it actually feels unpleasant. No, that's the whole...
Yeah. But it isn't unpleasant. People are still getting, like, so much, like,
no, but that's what the common,
out of it.
The common
yeah, it is,
conversation
yeah.
is, right?
Yeah.
I
so
have...
it's okay to get kicks out of yeah. it because, like, it's a criticism of it.
Is the way that Django and, like, say, Beatrice Kiddo from, like, Kill Bill, is there an analog there? Like, is there some sort of
revenge
attitude?
Porn.
Right, but I mean, like, an analog in terms of, like, the treatment of, like, a female character versus, like, of a black character by this white male director. Like, is there something there?
You know, like, actually, I think that they're both pretty non-agentic, but actually, like, I don't really want to get into it, but, like...
Yeah.
I feel like
they must be exactly
like,
the same character.
No, the narrative is kind of driven for the first half of Django by, like, a white guy who, like, saves Django and then, like, teaches him everything he knows, and then Django takes over.
Beatrice Kiddo have one of those? She had that dude who taught her how to punch her way
out
of that
coffin. Yeah, but he doesn't... He's
just a... Yeah, that dude.
No, he's
yeah.
there for the plot, but he's just, like, a scene or two. Like, the movie... Like, I would say, like, Christoph Waltz is as much a protagonist as Django. And it's kind of like, if it weren't for this white dude, like, he would never have done these... Like, so anyway, there's some race stuff, but I don't think it's, like, a racist film. It's an interesting film, and I'm confused about a lot of the race politics, too.
Yeah.
But that's, like so...
But it's, like, Inglourious Basterds, too. I'm like, is it weird race-wise? Is it not? I mean, I think that's more interesting than if it was just, like, it's clearly racist.
Yeah.
But I think that it is, he's doing something interesting in trying to be, like, here's a Western from, like, how a Western would be if it was about, or if black people were allowed to have anything to do with Westerns.
Yeah.
And I think that's super interesting. And I don't
think
that, like...
That's a very good way of phrasing it.
I don't think that just because, like, a white guy taught him lots, that makes it automatically racist. You know what
I
mean?
Oh, absolutely not.
And it happens a lot. There's always the trope in everything of, like, having an older guy teach, like, the younger guy all of the tricks.
That tends to be within narratives about race, too. There tends to always be a white guy.
Yeah, and it happens with, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, too. It happens a lot with women.
Yeah.
But it also happens, like, what about... Gandalf, is he not a mentor to, like, Frodo
but,
and
Bilbo?
I mean,
more than that,
Bilbo?
Like, Balbo, Galbo, within, like, racial narratives, like, there does, like, in The Help, there's that white lady.
But that one's
in...
way more problematic than this one.
Okay.
It's,
I haven't seen it yet,
like,
but I mean,
think,
just
yeah.
this idea of the white character who's there.
Yeah, but it's, like,
and...
the white character saves the day in The Help. Like, it's, like, she wrote a book. Not to talk just about The Help, but spoilers for The Help. She writes a book using all of these black stories and still gets credit.
She gets profit from it, doesn't she? We can do spoilers for so many movies on this, but, like, spoilers for Hairspray when the white chick causes. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, like, I just want to say one more thing.
White
about,
women, am I right?
Yeah. One more thing about Django before we kind of, or whatever. I just think one thing that I like about it, and I don't think it's a racist movie, one thing that I think is potentially an interesting way to read the film is that, like, he creates tension in his audience by showing you when you sit there and you're like, is this problematic? Isn't it problematic?
Yeah.
Which category does this fit into? And he creates a lot of tension Because we have to sit there with these characters who we are not sure if they are problematic or offensive or what they're doing, if they're subversive, if they're progressive, if they're not, if they're just, like, lying there flat, neutral. Like, we don't know. And we have nowhere to really put them in our head in a film that is, like, constructing an expectation to be really racialized in some way. And so you go in with this expectation that you're going to be able to lump it into the one of these kinds of binaries, and he doesn't really allow you that sort of satisfaction. I think that's a really interesting thing to do to your audience, and it's very, like, kind of post-structural. So I actually really enjoyed it for that reason, and I don't know that it was his intention, but I say, like,
I think it definitely was. I mean, not that it's that important what his intention is, but he's obviously, like, super into blaxploitation and has done, like, work with it before, and he's, like, definitely knows so much about film genre. Mm-hmm. I think that he would know what he's getting into and be like, here, it's not racist for all of these reasons, or it's complicating it, but doesn't matter. It is really interesting for all those reasons that you said. But there is something of, like, rewriting history, which I think is super weird. I mean, I definitely think the past two films are my favorite.
Well, Inglourious Basterds was actually such a good movie.
This movie was really good, too. I really enjoyed it. But there is something that I can't write about that somebody in the world has probably already written about. The weirdness
of, like, historical revisionism?
Yeah, and, like, what... And revenge porn yet again.
But I think it's a really interesting, I don't know if I said this to either of you, but, like, just given sort of how much Tarantino's films are about, like, loving films, like, that, you know, the first feature-length film was a rewriting of the Civil War in which the South wins, it really, you know, Birth of a Nation really, like, valorizes the KKK. It's interesting to kind of take a Western and then rewrite it, a sort of revenge porn, and... you know, against white people, basically, or against these oppressors and these groups that that sort of, like, you know, sold slaves. And I think that...
Take that, D.W. Griffith.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting kind of piece to add to, like, that canon of rewriting. Yeah. Especially in light of that film, which is, like, incredibly seminal in film history. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know, like, I also can't really speak too much about, like, revisionism because I know nothing about it and there's so much to there. But, like, there's something really interesting about situating Django in that body of work that I think is kind of cool.
I want to see it because I, like, have a million thoughts about Inglourious Basterds and I really liked it, and I think this is located in the same intellectual sphere. I also just, like...
I mean, Inglourious Basterds was less genre.
Yeah,
I
think it was there was still a lot of genre going on.
What genre was Inglourious Basterds?
I don't know. It's just, I think it was better than Django Boy.
It was playing
with Oh, you were saying it was better, but I was just wondering if it was playing with a specific gender. Genre.
I'm excited to see Django and have opinions about it. I also have to say, though, like, with Inglourious Basterds, and maybe about this one, too, if I enjoy it, I'm surprised at how good Inglourious Basterds is, because I just don't believe that Tarantino's that good.
I know, yeah, totally.
Like, whenever
none of you film people ever believe that he's good, but then when he makes a good movie like Inglourious, everyone's always like, it's good, but I still hate him.
Yeah, well, and just,
so,
like,
much hate on for him.
When Inglourious Basterds is at its best, for me, like, when you're watching... the Nazis watch that guy sniping Jews, but then, like, 2 seconds later, you're in that exact same position watching Nazis die. And it's, like, this really good translation of spectatorship and whatever. Like, I don't believe that this guy, who seems kind of squirrely and weird, knew that was gonna happen.
But I think he did.
But that's the thing, like, obviously he did, but I don't want him to have, I don't want
I mean, I don't love most of his movies, but I think these past two ones have been really, really brilliant.
I want him, like, I don't want...
Or maybe we're in the right genre, I mean, the right age group.
Yeah, maybe we'll go back
finally for it. I mean, we weren't the right age group for Pulp Fiction. Maybe that was, like, obviously it was mind-blowing when it came out.
Yeah.
And we weren't even for Kill Bill, we were still too young for it.
I loved it. But I think that there's a backlash effect to film students because everybody, like, so many people, there's such an overlove of Tarantino in, like, you know, intro to film, and then by the time...
There's an overlove in him in outro to film, too.
But I was just gonna say, like, everyone I know that, like, came from a film kind of program, basically, like, by the time they're graduating, like, hates Tarantino and, like, used to love them. Or often, many people used to love them. So I think that there's just, like, weird with Tarantino because he's so excessive too, but there's either too much hate or too much love for him. When he's like, he has his place, he does okay stuff, and sometimes his movies are, like, pretty good.
Yeah, gender is weird in them though, am I right?
Yeah,
totally right. Bye! And if you have more thoughts about gender, we're online at a website of onezone.com. If you have questions, comments about The Hobbit, and
Silver Linings Playbook.
Silver Linings Playbook, the 1 second of Kate Blanchett, the several seconds of Jennifer Lawrence. Maybe there's other women in it. I don't know. There's some wit ladies in Django Unchained. I assume some of them are white, some of them are black. Can't
there's
we all just live together?
You know what was
there's a white
weird?
One and a black one.
Why did the white one have to die? Why
she's
did
white.
It kill her?
Oh, you have to die.
No.
She also was, like, pretty much a slave master. We should cut this off!
I don't know.
She was inspecting, like, the black women to see which ones they should buy.
Visit us online!